From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. House Democrats have filed an impeachment resolution against President Trump. The resolution blames Trump for inciting an insurrection with remarks he made last Wednesday. Democrats specifically pointed to this moment from President Trump's rally that day.
We fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Trump's words just hours before a mob smashed and looted the Capitol building. The House will vote on impeachment Wednesday. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. And Kelsey, tell us more about this impeachment resolution. What does it say?
Yeah, it's one single article, and it's incitement of insurrection. It details Trump's actions in rallying his supporters, what we heard there and some additional moments from his speech, and spreading misinformation about the election, as well as his call to the Georgia Secretary of State. They refer to that as an attempt to overturn the election. Democrats say it all amounts to an attempt to interfere with congressional constitutional duty and subverts the president's duties as president. The article is very short. It's just 4 pages. And it ends by saying Trump acted in a manner that is grossly incompatible with self-governance and the rule of law. But it's garnering tremendous support from House Democrats. More than 200 co-sponsors have signed on. And House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer told reporters in the Capitol just a little bit ago that he expects a vote could happen Wednesday and that he would like to see it move quickly to the Senate.
And this is really already the second major development of the day, because this morning House Democrats also tried to adopt a resolution calling on Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from power. Now, that measure failed, but we're expecting a vote on it tomorrow. So what exactly happened, Kelsey?
Right. So Democrats brought up the measure in a way that would have required unanimous approval to move forward. They knew fairly well that at least one Republican would object, which is exactly what happened. Pelosi told her members in a letter yesterday that she was giving Pence 24 hours after that objection to respond, before she was going to hold another vote on that measure. Basically, she wants Pence to take action between now and tomorrow to start the process of removing Trump from office without Congress having to intervene. You know, Democrats have insisted that it would be best for the country if Trump would either leave on his own or if Pence and his cabinet would take action. It would take a vote of the majority of the cabinet for that to happen, though, and we haven't seen signs that that's an imminent development of any kind. So, barring some action from Pence, the House is expected to move to formally compel Pence to act, which is, again, kind of mostly a symbolic vote. But like I said, Democrats want to show that they did whatever they could to try to get the White House to act without congressional intervention. But they plan to move pretty quickly to the impeachment resolution that was introduced today.
I see. So they're giving Pence this opportunity, but there's no indication that he will actually take it. And so if he doesn't, Kelsey, House members will move to impeach the president. Again, no president has ever been impeached twice. Would any Republicans sign on to that effort?
Yeah, the main sponsor, David Cicilline, says he expects they will have GOP support for impeachment, but there are no Republican co-sponsors right now. I mean, there are plenty of Republicans who are very, very upset with the president's actions. They feel that the president cannot remain in office, but they have been quite quiet. We've heard from a small number of Republicans who have been willing to speak out. People come to mind. Is Pat Toomey, the retiring senator from Pennsylvania, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Mitt Romney of Utah, and a number of House members. But this is a very difficult situation for them to be in. It is a moment where they will be asked in the next couple of days to go on record, at least House Republicans, in at least 2 votes opposing the president and saying that he needs to be removed from office. It will be a very, very public display of whether or not the party is holding with Trump or if they are holding, you know, together with other members of Congress who feel outraged about what happened last week.
Sure. And if articles of impeachment then move to the Senate for a trial, it would trigger a lengthy process, which we're all very familiar with from the trial just less than a year ago. You know, senators would be sitting on the Senate floor 6 days a week. This would be after Biden's inauguration. And you know, Democrats just fought so hard in Georgia, Kelsey, to win control of the Senate. I wonder if they have any concern that going down the impeachment path again could interfere with the first weeks of President Biden's legislative agenda.
There certainly are those concerns. But as I talk to Democrats, they say they're also deeply concerned about the possibility of Trump being allowed to leave office without facing any real consequences for what happened. They say that they need to act and they don't feel that they have any other choice. They also would like very much for the Senate to vote to convict, because after a vote for conviction, there would be the opportunity to vote for by the Senate to say that Trump can never hold federal office again. And Democrats say they want that to be done. They want to make sure sure that Trump can't ever run again as he has suggested he might.
Sure. So there's maybe one reason for Democrats to move forward. On the other hand, they may also have to think about whether moving down the impeachment road again will inflame an already very partisan Congress. That's NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Thanks, Kelsey.
Thanks for having me.
And there are a lot of legal questions to parse out here, so let's see if we can get some of them answered with Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Jessica, welcome back.
Thank you.
And we just heard Kelsey Snell there describe how Democrats and maybe even some Republicans are trying to hold the president accountable for the insurrection last week, either through the 25th Amendment or through impeachment. What are some of the top legal questions on your mind right now?
Well, I mean, the biggest question, of course, is how far can we go when it comes to an impeachment for a president that likely will not be in office when the trial happens? So we're in the realm of unprecedented. We are in a norm-breaking presidency, already in a place where there are certain constitutional questions that simply have not been answered. We basically know when the 25th Amendment can be invoked, Section 4, but again, we've never done it before. So I think the big legal question is the timing of the impeachment.
Right, because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that the Senate would not start an impeachment trial until January 19th, and that's the day before Joe Biden's inauguration. So how are we going to figure that out? Well, you know, who's going to decide whether or not that can happen?
Well, I think that the best answer is that the Senate trial can absolutely go forward. I think the best answer, looking at the Constitution, and again, the reason I'm saying best answer is because we've never tested this before, which is good news, right? We don't want to continually test this constitutional provision. We don't want to continually be here. But I think the best answer is that as long as the House impeaches during the president's term, and that might not even be necessary, then the Senate trial can stretch after the president's term. I read the Constitution as absolutely allowing that. Then it really becomes a political calculation of, again, how much does it infringe on President Biden's first 100 days, whether or not you can get two-thirds of the Senate, which you probably can't, and whether or not it's worth it to say, since you can't remove the president once he's out of office, you know, the ultimate consequence at this point would be, Mr. President, you cannot run again. Don't pretend you can run again. And don't try and raise funds for the next 4 years to run again.
And Kelsey Snell brought this up. That would be a separate vote from conviction that would require just a simple majority of Democrats, which soon Democrats will have a simple majority because of the addition of the senators from Georgia. So let's just be clear about this. He could be acquitted, but he could still be allowed, never be allowed to hold office again.
I think that's the best way to read it, which is that the Senate would separately have to say what is the consequence. Let me point out, though, that I don't think that's settled. As there are many people who would say that you have to have that conviction first before you would then have that there's a repercussion here, and that the repercussion, again, being removal, which isn't on the table because this would happen after January 20th, or the repercussion would be you can't hold office again. It would, in a sense, it would be like sentencing somebody, and you don't sentence them until they've been convicted.
I see. Harvard Law School Emeritus Professor Alan Dershowitz told the New York Times that he would defend the president in an impeachment trial on free speech grounds. He said the president's speech is clearly protected by the First Amendment. What do you make of the defense?
What I make of that defense is that not much. I mean, to be totally honest, so we have a very robust First Amendment tradition in our country. And certainly you can say a lot of things and you can really rev up a crowd. And we want people to do that. We don't want anybody who gives a speech in front of a big audience to be constantly worried about, am I about to incite violence? But if you look at what the president said, I do not see here that there is the umbrella of First Amendment protection. Remember, you're not allowed to, this is the example we always use, but yell fire in a crowded theater. We know that inciting violence is a crime. It is something where we allow an infringement on the First Amendment because we say they're countervailing interests that are so important. I believe this is one of those cases. I don't see that First Amendment, again, umbrella of protection here.
We have just about a minute here. The president, has long been said to be considering a self-pardon, which would cover federal crimes. Now, there's a debate over whether he can do that because it's never been done before. Just walk me through how you think that might be challenged in court, and do you think it increases the chances that he would be charged with a crime so that it could be challenged?
Yeah. So in less than a minute, the way it would happen is the president would say, I'm going to pardon myself. And then the only way we can get a legal answer is that a federal prosecutor would then have to charge the president with a federal crime. He would have to use the self-pardon as a defense. And then the federal prosecutor would have to say, absolutely not. Self-pardons aren't allowed under the Constitution. And then you have your live case or controversy in a federal court. Then you go up, likely to Supreme Court. They answer it. Does it make it more likely that he'll be charged? I'm not sure. That depends on the appetite of federal prosecutors.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, thanks very much for your insights.
Thank you.
The mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, is calling on the federal government to help that city prepare for large groups of trained and armed extremists coming to town for Inauguration Day. Some fear a repeat of last week's violence when a mob of pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol building. And our next guest says things could get worse before they get better. Jonathan Greenblatt is CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, and he's with us now on a Skype line. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And why do you say that the security situation could get worse before it gets better?
Well, the ADL is the oldest anti-hate organization in the world. Our Center on Extremism tracks extremists from across the board. And we were in touch with law enforcement ahead of the event on January the 6th, warning them about the chatter we were seeing on the public web, on private forums, and on the dark web. And our Center on Extremism has uncovered a range of posts reacting to the event and spreading conspiracies and memes. And I must say, what happened last week literally was the most predictable terrorist attack in the history of this country. We knew that it was coming. And I'm saying now that we can't keep our heads in the sand, January 17th, where there's a Boogaloo rally planned in D.C., and January the 20th, the inauguration, already we're seeing on platforms like Telegram, or Parler before it went down last night, or others like VK.com, MeWe, the extremists are telling us that they, number one, feel emboldened because they believe that Wednesday was a watershed moment for the white supremacist movement. They literally rampaged through the Capitol with very little interference. And number two, they're now prepared to say, how do we fight the next battle? And they are looking for targets, and they want to disrupt what's coming, the government, the inauguration of Joe Biden.
Yeah, and as you just laid out, last week's insurrection was organized online, and we have since seen social media companies clamp down. I mean, they've even kicked the president, Twitter, kicked the president off its site forever. And the ADL has said that the extremist groups and conspiracy theories that motivated much of this violence are still easy to find online. So what do you think these tech companies should be doing to prevent things like what happened last week from happening again?
The tech companies have a big responsibility. The fact of the matter is that indeed this you called it an insurrection. I would call it a terror attack. It was planned out on the open on platforms like Twitter and Facebook, let alone other services like Parler and Telegram. The companies need to realize that freedom of expression isn't the freedom to incite violence. And as your prior guest said, it's not protected speech when you plan to attack a government building and, you know, to talk about executing elected officials, from Mike Pence to the members of Congress to the rest of them. So that stuff needs to be taken down. Now, we've had some really important developments in the last 24 hours. Number one, Parler went down last night. The right. degree of toxicity and violence voted on Parler would blow your mind. But it's not that they suddenly decided to enforce their terms of service. Apple, Google and Amazon said they don't want to do business with a company that is literally sowing chaos. Now, I think there are other companies that might not be the social media platforms themselves, but web security companies, hosting services, payment processors, all of them have the right to say, do they want their brands affiliated with companies that are literally allowing people to foment against our democracy?
Is it a game of whack-a-mole? So if Parler goes down, won't some other thing come up in its place?
Well, Twitter permanently banning President Trump, as happened last Friday, was an important step because he literally lost 90 million followers in one swoop. He may then have thought he could move to Parler, but now their 8 million users are out of luck. He may have to find that he moves to more and more marginal services. And as far as I'm concerned, we really literally have the threat of domestic terror. We have violence taking place in our nation's capital, the seat of government. So even if there's a bit of whack-a-mole here, I think that's a healthy process as businesses realize that they can't be places for hate. And at the end of the day, I think employees are not going to want to work at companies who are so out of line with basic core American values like decency and equality and normalcy. And that's a good thing. That's a healthy process.
The president has even said he suggested he might start his own social media company to get around some of these bans. Our listeners may have seen a widely circulated photo of a man at the Capitol last week wearing a sweatshirt that said Camp Auschwitz on the front of it. Of course, that's referring to the Nazi death camp. In the last couple of days, what more have we been learning about the ties that these rioters have to hate groups?
Oh, this was literally a who's who of right-wing supremacists, the right-wing extremist movement. You had anti-government groups who support President Trump and reject the fact that Biden won the election. You had conspiracy theorists, including QAnon people. You had Boogaloo types who may have viewed this as a step toward a coming civil war in which the government's supposedly coming for their guns. You had accelerationists and militant white supremacists who glorify the chaos and want a racial holy war. And finally, we had what you could call a growing pro-Trump extremist movement. I mean, this was really an ugly scene. And I would say that these people don't belong in the political conversation per se, not at all.
And as you say, there may be more to come. Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The number of new COVID-19 cases in the U.S. is still rising, and public health experts continue to remind us to wear masks and keep our distance. But for those working outside the home right now, employers play a large role in determining someone's risk of getting sick. A new data analysis by member station WBUR's investigative team shows just how frequently employers in Massachusetts are putting their employees and the public at risk. Shannon Dooling reports.
The outbreak at Horner Millwork, south of Boston, didn't happen all at once. The custom manufacturer of kitchens, doors, and windows started with just two employees testing positive for COVID-19 back in mid-April. Everything about the pandemic was still new then, and regulations in Massachusetts were rapidly changing. The company's owner, Peter Humphrey, took some measures to avoid a spread, but he stopped short of requiring employees to wear masks. Since then, a total of 30 workers have tested positive, nearly 10% of the workforce.
It kind of multiplied on us through early November when I would estimate we had 20 plus cases, probably 60 to 80 people additionally that were out because they were contact traced.
Humphrey says he notified town officials and was working with his own human resources team to inform employees of the increasing cases and provide COVID tests. But it wasn't until the state's Department of Labor Standards issued the Millwork Company a written warning and threatened thousands of dollars of fines that the company began cooperating with the state.
We originally, I'll say, resisted some because we were feeling we were doing a good job contact tracing. They convinced us that they need to do the contact tracing for people that maybe are not in our workforce, somebody's wife or child that lives with them or some friend they may have seen outside of work.
Humphrey admits he should have mandated mask wearing sooner, something he didn't put into place until the fall. Horner was one of more than 1,000 businesses included in WBUR's analysis of workplace complaints filed anonymously to a coronavirus hotline managed by the state's Department of Labor Standards. Some of the allegations included employers forcing symptomatic employees to come to work or not informing workers of positive cases. 74% of the complaints resulting in violations of state COVID workplace safety standards were centered in just four industries: retailers, restaurants, gyms, and salons.
Workers have to complain to start any kind of investigation or process.
Jody Sugarman-Brozan is executive director of the Massachusetts Coalition for Occupational Safety and Health.
Retaliation is high. We're relying on workers to protect themselves, and it's just not working.
She says the state regulations just aren't strong enough, and many employers aren't doing enough to make sure their workers are safe.
It has created a worker health and safety nightmare of unprecedented proportions.
Massachusetts isn't the only state struggling to preserve workplace safety amid the pandemic. In Iowa, more than 1,000 employees at a Tyson Foods pork processing plant have tested positive for COVID since the onset of the pandemic. The company is being sued by the family of an employee who died in April from complications of the virus. Recent court filings allege management placed bets on how many employees would get sick. And a meatpacking and processing plant just outside of L.A. was fined nearly $56,000 by the California Division of Occupational Safety and Health. Smithfield Foods allegedly failed to investigate a potential outbreak involving 300 employees at the plant. When it comes to keeping workers safe in a manufacturing plant, Adam Kaczynski, president of the manufacturing union Local 201, says you need to start with listening to the workers.
They know where there's not 6 feet of distance. They know where the ventilation's bad. So the best way to deal with COVID in a manufacturing environment is to listen to people on the floor and make sure they have the resources they need and the protections they need so that they don't get in trouble for speaking up.
Kaczynski is a milling machine operator at General Electric in Lynn, Massachusetts, just north of Boston. He's back at work now after recovering from COVID. Nearly half of the workplace complaints reviewed resulted in violations of state workplace safety standards. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Doolin.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
We're following the surge in COVID-19 cases across the U.S., but that wave is also rolling across the world. In Latin America, there have been more than 8 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus, and countries across the region are struggling to keep up with the surge. For more, let's bring in NPR's global health and development correspondent, Jason Beaubien. Jason, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Good to have you. And we're aware of the surge in countries like Argentina, Mexico and Peru, but where else are you seeing big jumps in cases?
So obviously Brazil, they've had more than 8 million cases in total, and the daily numbers there just sort of keep pushing up. Colombia also has a really strong outbreak there. They're the second highest in terms of daily tallies in Latin America. And then you've got a place like Uruguay, which it sort of seemed like it was the New Zealand of South America. You know, they had hardly any cases at all through mid-November. They thought that they really had this thing under control, and now they're seeing a big surge there. They recorded more than 1,000 cases yesterday, which is sort of off the charts for them.
Yeah, last month, the first batch of Pfizer vaccines arrived in Mexico. What's the plan to get those vaccines out to other countries?
Yeah, so currently, Mexico, as you mentioned, Costa Rica and Chile, they all have started sort of limited vaccinations with the Pfizer vaccine, again, heading towards those high-risk people, frontline healthcare workers. Argentina has started distributing the Russian Sputnik V vaccine, again, also to frontline healthcare workers. But many other countries are still, you know, it's really unclear when they're going to get a vaccine. Some haven't authorized a particular vaccine. Cuba is developing its own vaccine, and it's unclear when that's going to be ready. And others have authorized a vaccine and say that they're ready, but you've got every country in the world out there scrambling for doses if they can get their hands on them. And many in Latin America are not able to get their hands on those doses right now.
Well, exactly, Jason. We've been reporting on this concept of vaccine nationalism, where the richer countries are going to get the vaccines before the poorer countries. I mean, have you seen that? Is that a problem in Latin America? Are there countries that are not getting access to the vaccine just because they're a small little country and they don't have as much power?
Absolutely. And it's a huge problem. I mean, if you look at some of the poorer countries in Central America, when they're going to get the vaccine is completely unclear. And they are dependent on this COVAX facility, which is led by the WHO, which is a coalition of 190 countries. And they're going to try to get vaccine doses from the manufacturers and distribute them equitably among countries based on their population. But so far, they haven't distributed any through the COVAX facility. Mm-hmm. And right now, it's sort of the Wild West. Whatever country can get their hands on doses, they're doing it. You've got countries that are turning to the Russian Sputnik V vaccine because it's their only option at the moment. And even China is using the vaccine that they have to try to wield influence in the region and offering it to places that are, quite frankly, desperate at the moment.
And just briefly, are there any trends that you're seeing in Latin America that we might expect to see cropping up elsewhere around the world?
I think you're definitely going to continue to see this trend of the richer nations getting access faster than the poorer ones. And I think you're also going to see China and Russia attempting to make use of the vaccine that they do have for their own political and geopolitical benefit throughout the region.
All right. Jason Beaubien, NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
President-elect Joe Biden is announcing his choice to lead the Central Intelligence Agency. William Burns is a former U.S. ambassador to Russia and Jordan, and he served as Deputy Secretary of State during the Obama administration. He left government in 2014 to lead the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a foreign policy think tank. Let's bring in NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Callum.
So if he's confirmed, Greg, Burns will be the first CIA director in the agency's history whose wealth of experience comes primarily from the State Department. So is Biden signaling something about how he views the CIA, by choosing Burns as its director?
Well, this was certainly an interesting choice and in some ways a bit of surprise because, as you noted, he spent more than three decades in diplomacy, not intelligence. But in other ways, it does fit Biden's pattern for his national security team. Very experienced people who've worked together, known each other for many years. Bill Burns is not going to the CIA to overhaul it. He's going there because he has gold-plated Washington credentials. And even when Burns retired in 2014, he went into the think tank world. And so he's remained very much part of this national security and foreign policy world.
And, Burns fits the pattern not only because he's worked with some of the other folks on the national security team, but also because he worked with Biden when Biden was the vice president. So how are people in Washington reacting to that choice and this formation of a national security team that is familiar to the president-elect?
Yeah, it's been a very positive reaction so far. Burns's former colleagues at the State Department, as well as former CIA officials, are all endorsing him as extremely capable. And while he hasn't worked at the CIA, he's a very well-known quantity there. He was on the receiving end of CIA intelligence for many years as a diplomat. Now he'll be on the producing end. And we should note what a big contrast Biden's choice is with President Trump, who didn't have contacts in this world. Initially, he picked people he didn't know very well. And then in the latter part of his term, he's turned to political loyalists who face criticism for politicizing intelligence.
And of course, one of the things that he's known for as a diplomat is that he played an instrumental role in the negotiations that led up to the Iran nuclear deal in 2015, although he had left government by that point. He's been critical of President Trump's policy toward Iran, which, of course, included withdrawing the U.S. from that nuclear deal and imposing new sanctions on Iranian officials. So what kind of role could Burns play in Biden's plan for the Iran as the CIA director?
Well, as you noted, he was a key negotiator back when this deal was worked out in 2015. Joe Biden was a big supporter and would like to get back into it if Iran is willing to accept the restrictions. But we are 5 years down the road here. You can't just turn back the clock, so it will be a little bit tricky. One idea we're hearing is sort of a freeze for a freeze. The U.S. will freeze its sanctions. Iran will freeze its nuclear enrichment. Then both sides will try to sit down, figure out if there's a way they can get back to the deal. It's possible, but not a given.
All right. That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Thanks, Greg.
My pleasure.
And we want to spend a few minutes now remembering Neil Sheehan. He's the New York Times reporter who broke the story of the Pentagon Papers, the leaked documents that exposed widespread government deception about U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. Sheehan died last Thursday at the age of 84. Andrew Bacevich is president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, also a retired Army colonel who fought in Vietnam. He's with us now on Skype. And Andrew, on June 13th, 1971, Sheehan and the New York Times started publishing their reports on the leaked Pentagon Papers. It was a 7,000-page document commissioned by the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. Remind us, what did those papers reveal?
So the anti-Vietnam journalists had offered a contrary narrative, one that very much was at odds with the official narrative justifying the war, particularly during the Lyndon Johnson administration. What the Pentagon Papers did, again, commissioned by Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, but not revealed until McNamara and Johnson were gone and Richard Nixon was in office. What they revealed is that the government itself was aware of its conscious lies, was aware of the fact, even as the war was going on, that it was a massive mistake. In other words, the Pentagon Papers corroborated what the war correspondents had been saying all along. It is also the case that the Pentagon Papers made it unmistakably clear the level of deception that the United States government had engaged in during the conduct of the war, that there were secret aspects of this war, bombing Laos, bombing Cambodia, for example, that the government had quite intentionally kept the American people in the dark about. So the Pentagon Papers just provided a enormous clarity to a war that had been, from the very outset, a project that was shrouded in deception. And Sheehan, who had covered the war in the early stages, was prominent among the journalists who broke this story.
In 2017, I spoke with Daniel Ellsberg. That's the former defense analyst who first showed the papers to Sheehan. And Ellsberg told me about watching the 1967 March on the Pentagon by anti-war protesters from inside the Pentagon while he was working on the papers. And that was sitting not far from Defense Secretary Robert McNamara. Let's listen.
Pentagon Papers were being written in an office next to McNamara's office. And it was a Saturday, and I think it had been suggested that people not come in. So the office that I was in was almost deserted. And I went next door to McNamara's office, and he was standing there watching from a window. And I stood at another window and looked down at the arrests in the crowd.
Interesting bit of history there to hear from Daniel Ellsberg. Did you have any sense while you were fighting in Vietnam that your own government wasn't telling you and the American people back at home the truth about the war?
So, you know, I served late in the war, 70 to 71. So this was after the Tet Offensive of 1968. It was during the period when the drawdown of U.S. troops was in progress. In other words, it was obvious that we weren't going to win this war, and that therefore the sacrifices that had been made and were being made were going to count for nothing. So the mood of the time in country among those of us who were serving was, it was gloomy. It was hard to make sense of what we were experiencing. So the lies that engulf this war were massive, comprehensive, far-reaching. You know, you and I are talking the week after the siege of the Capitol, and that's rightly a big story. And if you go by the media reporting, you would think that this is the worst like thing we've ever experienced as a country. I have to tell you, as bad as things are right now, a year like 1968 was worse. Tet Offensive, Johnson announcing he's not going to run for a second term, Martin Luther King assassinated, Robert Kennedy assassinated, the eruption of violence in Chicago at the time of the Democratic National Convention. 1968, it wasn't difficult to imagine that this country was going to come apart. I don't think the country is in very good shape right now, but I must say, speaking personally, that I think that we have survived worse times than we are experiencing right now.
Well, and that's why I want to ask you, what lessons we still have to learn as a country today in 2021 from the lies that Neil Sheehan helped expose?
Well, the importance of telling the truth, obviously, but I think also the importance of being aware that the truth may be more complicated than you think. And my point there is that, you know, here we are today looking at our current situation with the Trump supporters sacking the Capitol. And we are all angry, and we should be angry and incensed that that is happening. And I think that the lesson of Neil Sheehan would say that be careful that you don't too quickly reach what you imagine to be a definitive conclusion. It may well be that your truth is more complicated, and therefore that the search for truth needs to continue beyond the present moment.
Andrew Bacevich, president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, on the legacy of reporter Neil Sheehan, who died last week. Andrew, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The social media service Parler is suing Amazon Web Services after Amazon suspended it. It is popular with conservatives and extremist Trump supporters, and this comes after Twitter permanently banned the president and Facebook banned him at least through the end of his term. Let's look at these moves and some of the reaction with Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And Derek, you know, Facebook and Twitter in particular have long struggled with how to handle misinformation from the president. So what do you make of their response to the insurrection now?
Right. I think the big question here is why now? I don't think you get very far by assuming that corporate America, and especially these large tech companies, randomly and spontaneously grew a conscience in the last 100 hours. I think it's important to state that these decisions came not only after these uniquely violent and deadly attack on the seat of government, but also it came after Democrats achieved unified government in Washington, after the two victories in the Georgia Senate election, after Congress certified the electoral defeat of President Trump. These corporate decisions are nested within the political environment. If you're a company that is dealing with President Trump as the president for the next 4 years, in this alternative reality where a lot of Trump fans live in, where he actually did win the 2020 election, then it's really dangerous to muffle or silence the most powerful man in the world. But that's not what Trump is anymore. Trump is now a lame duck president who is facing his second impeachment in, I don't know, 370 days. And that, I think, is why you are seeing these decisions being made, not only by Facebook and Twitter, but also Snapchat, Amazon, Apple, the PGA, Golf Association, Twitch, Shopify. All of these companies are cutting ties with the president and his supporters at the same time, and it has to do with the political reality on the ground.
Well, to that point, I mean, the statement from Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook CEO, pointed to the certification of Biden's win as a seminal moment, as if there had maybe been some doubt up to that point. So I'm curious what kind of reaction you're seeing to these moves, both from experts, but also in the political arena.
I think that's a fantastic point. You're right. The obviousness of President Trump's loss in November has been clear to lots of people for many, many weeks, but it required this official certification of the electors for all of these companies to make this decision. Of course, also the violent attack on the Capitol. The reaction, I think, it's been interesting. On the one hand, I think you have a lot of conservatives who are saying that, you know, look, it's really dangerous to essentially have these private companies or publicly traded companies held by private individuals who are essentially acting like governments by, you know, silencing various people on their platform. And they're, you know, pointing to the fact that this is a dangerous precedent to set. I am more on the side of people like the ACLU, which is essentially saying that, look, the president has been using these social media platforms to see doubt about the results of the election and incite a response to those so-called doubtful results that ended up killing people in a violent raid on the Capitol. So these moves, I think, are mostly long overdue rather than, I think, being an overreaction to the president. What he has done is historically unique, and it deserves a historically unique response.
Although, as you mentioned, the ACLU, they obviously came down hard on the president for, in their view, inciting the insurrection, but also said that they had some concern about taking him off of Facebook and Twitter. And I guess that sort of leads us to a question, Derek, about whether these moves are even effective, because after Twitter banned the president, the CEO of the social media platform, Gab, said that 10,000 users were joining that platform every hour on Saturday. Now, Gab is already popular on the far right. So, you know, if the president is forced off Twitter and Facebook, where does he go and where do his supporters go?
It's a great question. You know, you look at, you know, if they're not on Twitter, then where can they go? Well, maybe Facebook. Nope, Facebook has banned them. They can go to Twitch. Nope, Twitch has banned them. They can go to Parler. Nope, Parler has been taken down by Apple and Amazon. So where do they go next? Well, Gab is the next sort of candy in the Pez dispenser, I suppose you could say. It is the next one up. And you now see, obviously, the CEO of the social media platform Gab essentially saying that they are seeing record numbers of people join their site. But I wonder if you see the same sort of conspiracy theories and the same sort of violence being advocated for on Gab, is it going to face the same sort of censure that Parler did? I don't know the answer. And to your point, I think you're right. The ACLU has been both extremely critical of the president, but also concerned about these private companies, about these companies acting essentially as quasi-governments. I think it's possible that this could be a sort of one-off event, that the combination of Trump's loss, the Democrats' unified government, and the violent storming of the Capitol will mean that we have sort of a one-time pulse of corporate activity that tries to limit the president's exposure, and that this won't necessarily be a sense of things to come. This will be seen as sort of a unique moment in corporate censure of a president.
And of course, there are still questions to answer, like if these sort of formerly fringe websites are not really on the fringe anymore, what does that mean for our democracy? Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you, Derek, for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.